Good afternoon, everyone. Ambassadors, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Assalamu alaikum. Apologize for keeping you waiting a few minutes, but we had some technical difficulties with these microphones that we tried to work out, and we could not work out, so we're going to use these handheld mics. My name is Hadi Amr. I'm the director of the Brookings Doha Center and a fellow of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy in Washington. I'm especially proud to welcome you today to this event entitled Peace in the Pipeline, Prospects for Oil and Gas Cooperation in the Middle East and South Asia. I'm especially pleased because this event has a distinguished panel, which I'll introduce to you, and also because it is the result of the fruits of our research of our first visiting fellow, Dr. Salim Ali. And Dr. Ali will present his research, and then we will get additional perspective. Brookings is the oldest, one of the oldest and largest think tanks in the U.S., the oldest of its kind, established in 1916. The Brookings Doha Center was established just a year ago and inaugurated by His Excellency Sheikh Hamad, the Prime Minister. Our purpose is to bring together business, government, media, academia, and civil society to discuss the pressing public policy issues of the region. And as you can see with this panel, and the bios are on your chairs, we've done that today. Like Brookings Washington, Brookings Doha is open to a broad range of views, and each of the views expressed here are the views of the individuals, not of the institution, and we're proud of the fact that our research is independent and that our discussions are open. Our speakers today, again, you have their bios. To my left is Ambassador Mithat Rende, Ambassador of Turkey to Qatar. He's not only the ambassador to Turkey, a country which has a lot to do with pipelines, but he was previously Deputy Director General for Energy, Water, and Environment at the Ministries of Foreign Affairs in the Republic of Turkey from 2004 to 2007. Prior to that, he was head of the Department of Regional Transboundary Waters. So you can see he has a lot to do with energy and transboundary issues that this event will address. To my far left is Mr. Adel Ahmed Abul Ainain. He is the General Manager of Dolphin Energy, where he's in charge of Dolphin Energy's activities in the state of Qatar. And as you know, Dolphin Energy is in charge of the pipeline that transports natural gas between Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. Mr. Ainain has more than 30 years experience in the oil and gas industry, and he's held many titles in engineering and safety and operations. And in the middle is Dr. Salim Ali. Salim has been with us this semester, for those of you in academia, as a visiting scholar at the Brookings Doha Center. We had an event earlier where he discussed Pakistani madrasas, and here he's discussing his primary research with us, which has been oil and gas pipelines and cooperation in the region. So what I'd like to do now is turn the parole to Dr. Ali, who will present to us findings and recommendations from his report, and then we'll hear from the other speakers, and this will be followed by a question and answer session. And finally, before I turn the parole to Dr. Ali, I also want to welcome the audience on Jazeera Mubasha, and thank Al Jazeera for covering our event today. Salim, please.
Thank you very much, Hadi. My special thanks to the Brookings Doha Center and the Qatar Ministry of Foreign Affairs for hosting my visit here. This is my last week in Qatar before I return, and I've had a marvelous time here, so I'm very grateful for the hospitality and encouragement, especially of all the staff here at the center. The topic which I'll be presenting on is one which is fairly contentious at many levels. It's something something which is in some ways new and I might say is cutting edge at one level within political science at least. For engineers, it's not something new. Engineers have dealt with pipelines for decades. But the geopolitics of pipelines are only recently being studied at the level at which I'm trying to approach this. My contact details are given here, and I'm going to really breeze through the presentation. The report itself will be ready. The draft is ready, but it won't be publicly available for a couple of months as we go through the production process. The report is about 16,000 words, so it's hard to cover all that material in 10 to 15 minutes. So what I've tried to do is, using my old tricks as a teacher, is to try and give a lot of quotations and some images and maps to just give you a flavor for what some of the findings are. And then also, you have a handout. All of you should have on your seats a two-page handout which summarizes the policy recommendations. So I'm not going to be able to cover everything in detail, but I hope this will at least give you a good flavor for the issues. So I start the report by first looking at existing pipeline projects in the Middle East and North Africa region, which is referred to sometimes as the MENA region. And I start with the Iraq pipelines because they're some of the oldest in terms of when oil was discovered and when the infrastructure started to be built during the British colonial period. One particular pipeline that's of great interest nowadays, especially in the United States, has been this old pipeline from Kirkuk to Haifa, which of course is now in Israel, but that pipeline has not been resurrected. There was a proposal at one point to try and rebuild that after the U.S. 2003 occupation of Iraq, but that has not transpired. Of course, Jordan would have had to give permission and has not done so. Of course, the condition with the Arab-Israeli conflict being what it is, it's unlikely that that will move forward anytime soon. So I'm quite realistic in the report. I don't try to say that this is going to be a panacea. In all conflicts, you can get cooperation. But there are some where we can learn some lessons of how we can configure cooperation. I'll give you some examples of those. There's, of course, the Trans-Arabian Pipeline, which was built later on than this one and goes through Saudi Arabia. That one has been also out of service for various reasons. That one, there may be some potential. But the most active one, and that's where we're very, very fortunate to have Ambassador Rende with us, is the Iraq to Turkey pipeline. But Turkey, as we'll see, is the crossroads of many other projects. Then I also look at the Trans-Mediterranean pipeline projects, which are very interesting as well. Maybe I'll show you the maps as we talk, just to give you some idea. So those are the pipelines in the Middle East region, just to show you the level of complexity. I know you can't read all the figures in detail, but just to give you a sense of the complexity. And these are the pipelines in the North African region. Of particular interest are these three pipelines. The first one to be built was from Algeria to through Tunisia and then on to Sicily. This is the Transmed project. Then the other one, which I also looked at in considerable detail, was the one from Algeria to Morocco to Spain. And both of these projects are very interesting from a conflict perspective because, as many of you will know, Algeria and Morocco have had very strained relations. They have at one point they broke diplomatic ties for a period of more than 12 years because of Algeria's support for the Polisario rebels in Western Sahara. There has also been a territorial conflict between Algeria and Morocco since the colonial times. And then we also have a conflict between Morocco and Spain historically. There have been lots of contested territories. Even now there are some contested territories. And yet, despite all this, the pipeline was able to come forward. And as I present in the report, especially in this case, it really helped to bridge relations between these three countries. Then the third pipeline, which I also look at, is between Libya and Italy. This is the most recent of the Mediterranean pipelines. And it goes from, all the way the gas comes from here, goes across from Tripoli to Sicily, and it's a fairly deep water pipeline. So, okay, going back to the existing case studies, The Egypt-Israel-Jordan pipeline is another one which I looked at, and this is one which is, again, very recent, and it's a very controversial project. We tried to get some first-hand information on the Egypt-to-Israel portion, which just opened last year, and our very worthy staff member, Qais Sharif, was trying to get direct contact with the company in Cairo, and with several multiple faxes and phone calls and so on. We couldn't get a primary interview with the company executives, given the sensitivity of the issue, but with some investigative research going through Al Ahram weekly in various ways, we were able to get quite a bit of interesting information. The Egyptian government has been going through a lot of tension over that particular pipeline because there was a lawsuit that was lodged against the government for having approved the pipeline to Israel without going through a full parliamentary procedure. That lawsuit was dismissed in February of this year. Initially in November, it went forward and the judges ruled in favor of the complaint filers, but then it was rescinded in February. So it's again a very interesting, intriguing case which has not received much research attention, and I think this is really going to be the first report which looks into that particular case. I also look at, of course, the Dolphin Project, which is in many ways a great success story of regional cooperation, and we're very fortunate to have Mr. Adil with us to give more details about that project. This was not as politically charged, but it is important to recognize that there were several territorial disputes between some of the countries involved, and those disputes were resolved prior to the project. So again, the argument can be made that cooperation was fostered as a result of that pipeline moving forward, and I present some sequence analysis of how that happened. And then, so the first half of the paper looks at some of these projects which are existing. I should mention these are the last two ones quickly also. The Turkmenistan-Iran-Turkey pipeline is a very interesting case because, of course, the U.S. has opposed any kind of commercial interactions with Iran, but in this case, they were willing to not take any action regarding this pipeline. One argument was made that the gas was initially coming from Turkmenistan, and so it was not Iranian gas, but then after 2001 actually Iranian gas was also being pumped, but it's a positive step that in fact this particular issue was not brought up, and again we're very fortunate to have Ambassador Rende who will comment on that. We also have a little bit of a mention of the Baku-Tbilisi-Tehran case. I have not spent too much time in the report about this particular pipeline because a lot has been written on it and I didn't want to reinvent the wheel. This particular pipeline was between Azerbaijan and Turkey, and the routing of this pipeline was particularly interesting. I don't think we can see that on the map. We don't have a map of this one. But it basically goes around... Oh, actually, Ambassador Rende has the map, so that's wonderful. Those of you who are interested... let me see, I thought I had one more map, this one. But anyhow, this particular project goes from Azerbaijan around Armenia, so it goes north to Georgia and then south into Turkey. So it makes a bit of a detour to avoid Armenia. And one argument could be made that this was a strategic decision not to get into a conflict situation because, of course, there haven't been very good relations between Turkey and Armenia or between Azerbaijan and Armenia. One argument could be made that this was a missed opportunity, that you could have maybe used the pipeline for conflict resolution. But the other argument, which I think Turkey makes very eloquently, is that this was an opportunity to provide development to Georgia, which had previously been a marginalized state in the region. And so that was a positive development as well. So that's how we would perhaps like to approach it. Now, just to give you some examples of how cooperation can be fostered, and as I said, I'll give you some quotations just because of sometimes it's faster to be able to cover a lot of issues with a few sound bites. When the Green Stream pipeline was opened, between Libya and Italy. This is an example of, again, how cooperation was fostered very specifically to use that particular opportunity. And these are quotations from the Libyan leader and the Italian prime minister. The date is very significant. 7th October 2004 is the date of the Italian invasion of Libya. October 7th is the date of the Italian invasion of Libya, of course, several decades earlier. So this was a commemoration of that day, but the day was chosen to show, look, now we are using this opportunity to improve ties between the countries. And as you can see from these quotations, the direct connection was made in this regard. In this case, it's also important to recognize that Libya was a colony of Italy, and there have been about 20,000 Italians who had been expelled from Libya at the time of the Gaddafi regime assuming power in 1969, I think. When was it? So at that point, there were 20,000 of these Italians who were actually expelled, and at this point, on October 7, 2004, Mr. Gaddafi said that he was going to actually use this as an opportunity to allow them back into Libya. So just to give you an example. Now, another interesting case is with regard to Asia. Pipelines are also being developed all across Asia, and this is an example of how we can think of pipelines as a means of what we call in the political science common aversions being used for cooperation. So when you have something that both sides do not particularly like, it can actually lead to cooperative behavior as well. So this is a quotation from the senior minister for State of Foreign Affairs of Singapore, and how he described the importance of pipelines in this particular context. And the point I'm trying to make in this regard is that pipelines can not only maybe cause cooperation when they are established, but they can sustain cooperation, because when you have that infrastructure linkage, you do have more of an incentive to cooperate. And that is what he's trying to get at here, that they raise the cost of non-compliance or the cost of not being able to engage in the long run as well. The second part of the report looked at future pipeline projects. And in this part of the report, I was particularly keen to study the South Asian pipeline projects which have been proposed. And there are two very significant ones which are presented here. Both of them, the target demand centers are India, which is going to be a major source of energy demand in the near future. One project which was initially supported by the Pakistani government as the top priority was from Turkmenistan going to Pakistan and then on to India later on. But Pakistan was interested just having gas for itself also, even if India was not interested. This would have come from the Daulatabad field in Turkmenistan and would have gone along the route from Herat to Kandahar along the road in Afghanistan and then into Pakistan. This is the shortest of the projects. And what one could argue is that this would have actually helped to foster cooperation between Central Asia and South Asia, but also between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which have had historically very poor relations also. The other project is between Iran, Pakistan and India, and this is called the IPI project. This is a longer project, and in many ways this is a more contentious one because of Iran's involvement, the US had very clearly opposed it, and I provide a clear analysis of how the US government tried to configure their operations in South Asia to initially oppose this project, but then their stance has changed in the last 2 years. And my own recommendation, which I haven't put in the handout very clearly, is that this is an area where the Obama administration should reconsider their support for a project like this, because it provides a win-win opportunity to also improve relations between the United States and Iran, and it improves relations between Iran Iran and Pakistan and India, which would be of to any everyone's benefit. I should mention the routing of this pipeline has been changed. It was initially going to go through here. This is the latest map which I got from the interstate gas systems. And initially it used to be, if you see old maps, it was going through Balochistan in this area, which is a very security, high security area, a lot of problems with insurgency here. So now they have made it along the coast, which is acceptable. The Pakistani parliament has approved this routing of the project, and in fact now, just last week, the latest news is that this project from Turkmenistan, which has been also pursued simultaneously, this is going to be rerouted. So now the new route, and I wasn't even able to put it on a map because it just happened within the last 5 days, that this routing will now, from here, only a small portion of Afghanistan will be covered, because this area has become very unstable. And as you know, just sadly 2-3 days ago there was a big bombing here in Farah province, and so this is an extremely difficult area, and so now it's going to be rerouted this way into Khorasan in Iran, and it will actually be linked to the IPI project. So Afghanistan will still get some transit fees, but not as much, of course. And the field has also been changed. So there's a Japanese company has gone and certified another field next to the Ghaltabad field in terms of the gas reserves. And so that is most likely to happen in that regard. So these pipeline projects I present as a futuristic analysis, having looked at the past projects. My own suggestion is that these are very promising projects and should be encouraged in terms of financing, in terms of diplomatic support, given the experiences from some of these other projects as well. And then finally, I'll just conclude with another quotation, that I think we also need to go beyond the rhetoric of what has been referred to as the resource curse or the great game. Many times when we talk about oil and gas, there's a tendency among political analysts to always have some kind of conspiratorial mindset. And I found this quotation from the current president of the Brookings Institution, incidentally, but who used to be the number two person at the State Department, and he made this comment specifically while addressing an audience that was looking at the issue of oil and gas pipelines. And people were asking about this issue of the great game, which you, some of you, especially the British in the audience, would probably recognize is something that's become a part of folklore, about how oil and gas have been the way by which countries have tried to manipulate their interests in Central Asia. And Talbot himself recognized that we need to move beyond that kind of rhetoric. Whether that is going to happen or not remains to be seen. It's an issue of leadership. It's an issue of how much we are able to influence policy as analysts, as people who are approaching this issue, as engineers, as scientists also, and see whether there can be something that can be done at a more pragmatic level. I'm very optimistic, and in the analysis I present some ideas in that regard. I also have some very specific policy recommendations, both for the source and demand countries, which you can have a look at, and then also recommendations for other external parties. There's a growing international interest in governance systems for oil and gas pipelines. There's an energy charter treaty, which is gaining momentum, and there is a specific protocol which is being developed as part of the energy charter treaty that specifically focuses on oil and gas pipelines and transit states. So this is not pie in the sky. This is very realistic. This is something that has happened. I've given you examples of how it has worked between North Africa and Europe, between the Middle Eastern states, and so we should hopefully give it some importance as well in the region.
Thank you. Thank you, Salim. Mr. Ambassador, if you'd like to... Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. First of all, I wish to express my most sincere thanks to Mr. Hadi Amer for the opportunity to speak tonight. And it's a pleasure to have such a distinguished audience. And it's challenging. I understand that we have a lot of experts here in Doha.
energy experts. But also I would like to thank my friend Dr. Salim Ali for the introduction and for sharing with us his conclusions regarding a very important issue. Before sharing with you my humble views regarding pipeline politics and pipelines in and around Turkey, I would like to make a few remarks. First of all, I believe that energy issues, they are political issues, and energy will be further politicized in the years to come. Energy security is a global matter, energy supply security, and it should be dealt with at global level. Consumers, transit countries, and producers should be able to cooperate, get together and cooperate, and find ways and means in the interest of all. Having said this, I also think that energy will remain to be a foreign policy tool, energy resources and pipelines, especially at a time when we have limited access to energy and fewer investment and lack of understanding among the interested countries to build new pipelines, especially natural gas pipelines. In our region, we have Europe, which is a huge consumer, a group of consumers, and especially the natural gas. In terms of natural gas, the consumption will increase by some 70% by 2030. Today's consumption is about 500 billion cubic meters, and it should reach 700 to 800 billion cubic meters. Then, on the other side, we have, of course, the Middle East and further north, which has over 65% of the total energy, namely gas and oil. And so the problem is, as regards my country, Turkey, which is sitting between the two regions, is how to play the transit country role and what to do in order to, first of all, guarantee its own security of supplies and then to provide its territories for oil and gas pipelines to transit gas and oil to the West and to add to contribute to energy security of supplies. We have started by building several pipelines. The first one we managed to build was 30 years ago. That is the Kirkuk Ceyhan pipeline. That is the double pipeline which carried the Kirkuk oil and Iraqi oil to the Mediterranean port of Yumurtalık, but now we call it Ceyhan. And we started experiencing the first goes through the first experience we had as regards pipelines. That was the Kirkuk southern Mediterranean port of Ceyhan. But this pipeline, unfortunately, we had many problems in securing the constant flow because of various attacks on the other side of the border in Iraq. Baku Tbilisi-Ceyhan was a new experience for us. Baku Tbilisi-Ceyhan is 1770 kilometers. It crosses, of course, from Sangachal oil terminal on the Caspian Sea to Tbilisi, and from Tbilisi to Kars and through Turkey to the southern Mediterranean port of Ceyhan. It took some time to convince the international community to build this pipeline. I was in London when some major oil companies' representatives used to speak during conferences. Thank you, yes. Thank you so much. Yes, that's very kind. From here. Yes. In London during the 90s, there was a great struggle to avoid the building of this pipeline. And I remember some representatives who used to call it a dream, it will never come true. And finally, we managed to cooperate with the oil companies, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Turkey, and finally we managed to build the pipeline. The pipeline is quite important because it carries 1 million. It carries 1 million tons of oil. I'm sorry, that is the gas. That's the gas. It should go like this. Yeah. This is. So it carries 1 million barrels of oil a day, and also it bypasses two important territories. One is the Russian territory. This is the first pipeline which bypasses Russian territory, and secondly it bypasses the Turkish Straits, because here we have at least 3.2 million barrels of oil crossing the Turkish Straits and the Bosphorus especially, and it's quite dangerous to have ultra large oil carriers and big tankers to cross the Bosphorus, a heavily inhabited area. And we had many accidents in the past, so we tried to bypass the straits. But the Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan pipeline is a great success. In fact, I have been asked by the Indian authorities to speak about Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan when I visited three years ago New Delhi, and they wanted to learn from this experience because they were interested in concluding their own intra-governmental agreement and host countries agreement with Pakistan and in Iran, because they wanted to conclude the Iran-Pakistan India pipelines, and they were concerned because of the lack of trust and confidence among the countries concerned. And we explained to them at length how things can be done, and how when the interests are converging, how can we reach agreements in the interest of all countries. And then we explained to them that they can also refer to the principle of take or pay, pump, ship or pay, all the principles that create mutual trust, or they create the mechanisms for the constant flow of oil or gas. So I think BTC has been a good example in this regard, and it is with its very, very complicated, comprehensive legal framework, it has been used as a good sample for future networks and future pipelines. But of course, every pipeline has its own peculiarities. The political conditions are different. Dr. Ali rightly said that this pipeline bypassed or avoided Armenia. Yes, it did, because of the political situation in the region. But of course, Georgia benefited from it, and now Georgia is politically also connected with Turkey and Azerbaijan, not only economically through this pipeline. Another pipeline which we managed to build is also a gas pipeline, and that is the, of course, Iran-Turkey pipeline. And we completed also another gas pipeline from Baku to Erzurum, and then connected to the Turkish national grid. And this is a gas pipeline. So we have a natural gas pipeline connecting. But coming back to Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan, the aim is to connect Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan to Aktau in Kazakhstan, and then Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, they have signed an agreement, and the aim is to pump like about 7 to 10 million tons of oil per year. And so in this case, of course, the connection would be, the pipeline would be complete. Another project which is very ambitious is to connect, also to build the Trans-Caspian gas pipeline and connect Turkmen gas to the Turkish grid and from there to Europe. And Nabucco, of course, most of you have heard about this, an ambitious project which is going to cost over 11 billion euros, the 3,300 kilometers Nabucco. It should also benefit. I'm sorry, I can share with some of the some of our colleagues who are interested in having copies of these. Nabucco is a very important strategic natural gas pipeline, and the aim is to carry gas from the Caspian as far as Turkmenistan through Turkey to Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, and then to Baumgarten in Austria. This is an expensive project, but the aim is to carry 5% of the total consumption of the European Union when it is completed. The European Union Energy Commissioner expressed strong interest in this project, and recently the relevant leaders, including the President of Turkey and other presidents, they gathered in Prague and they signed a memorandum of understanding about this project. The aim is to carry gas to Europe and to offer more diversification of resources and routes. While we are in cooperation with other countries trying to build Nabucco, of course the Russian Federation is also introducing new projects. We have also a direct pipeline, and that is the Blue Stream, and it was a very timely also a project for Turkey in order to meet its high energy demand, gas demand, and also to provide also supply, to diversify its supplies. You might recall that in 2006, 1st of January, Ukraine was surprised when the Russians cut off their the gas. That was the 1st of January 2006, and of course Turkey has suffered from this. On the 4th of July, on the 4th of January, 3 days after this incident, the Energy Commissioner of the European Union gathered all energy ministers of the European Union and decided to start a new energy strategy and to diversify sources and routes. And finally came the white paper, the green paper first and then the white paper, and Europe decided that it wouldn't be enough to have only natural gas from the Russian Federation, Algeria, and Nigeria. So they started their studies for a fourth artery, and that is through Turkey. The topic is how, when I had a word with Dr. Ali, he told me that in his study he focused on how to improve relations, political relationships between countries through pipelines. I believe we can. For example, the situation between Iraq and Turkey. We have the double pipeline with a capacity of 1.6 million barrels of oil per day. It's not totally used, but we are planning to build a parallel gas pipeline in order to also carry the gas of Iraq to the Mediterranean. With the Iraqis, we have this joint a big pipeline. It's a joint project, so they are quite careful to protect our interests and their interests. As regards the BTC, of course, it's connecting the three countries and beyond. Nabucco will connect more than maybe 10 countries. And if the situation improves in Iran, we might be able also to use Iranian gas, but not for the short, not in the short period. We believe that pipelines, although there's a big struggle in order to build pipelines bypassing certain countries or avoiding certain routes, still I believe that pipelines will contribute to political stability and security in the region, in our region of course, as far as Turkey is concerned. And we hope that that we can realize, especially Nabucco, which is really a strategic pipeline, in the years to come. I think I should stop here, and then if there's any question I can take. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Mr. Adel, if you'd like to continue and offer us your thoughts and wisdom from someone who's actually managing a pipeline, and again, you know, one that connects Qatar with its neighbors.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you, Adi, for introducing me. Thank you very much for inviting me today for this evening for this Doha Proving Center. I'm happy to be here representing Dolphin Energy as a pioneer, as a project of everybody heard about it, where we have this connected three nations, the Qatar, UAE, and Oman. Basically, just I mean, when we talk about the gas pipeline, are really literally conducted through the which collaboration and cooperation between the countries. often they are catalysts for the number of initiatives that prevail beyond the original agreement. There are things which are not only part of agreement, but there are beyond the whatever agreement signed between the countries or between the different entity. I think when we talk about Dolphin project or Dolphin gas project, as Dolphin Energy as a compelling example to promoting cooperation, not just the success of the project, but how we collaborated to address the challenges faced. There are a number of challenges faced during the project execution, during the negotiation earlier at this earlier stage. So these were a lot of challenges just to have this project success. Today I can just highlight a few points about put more focus about the Dolphin, how it developed the relationship beyond its the core business. As a matter of fact, I mean, it is also a great example of the benefits to be gleaned from the cooperation. They consider how this project, because of the enduring support of the government of the Qatar, UAE, and Oman, and thus that would be success without this cooperation, and that was very essential factor to enabling the national and the international stakeholders in Dolphin to assemble, and the skills, technology, and multidisciplinary implementation teams essential to success this great and unique project. When I say unique project, because this is in the region, it's the we talk about the region here, which is in the GCC. It's the first of its kind, which has this connecting three countries. And I think there are a lot of benefits other than the commercial and other than the demand or the high demand of energy. The Dolphin project has also demonstrated an important level of cooperation because of the profiling that is shareholders. You know, the shareholders for Dolphin Energy, the Mubadala, which Abu Dhabi based, Mubadala Development, and then have Occidental Petroleum, the United States, and the Total of France. So you can imagine all these companies across the world world, they come together and invest and try to have this gas exported from Qatar to UAE and through Oman. This structure is really a partnership, I mean, because of our keenness to ensure that we gleaned expertise and insight from our partners, as all they put all the efforts together, try to develop a reciprocal agreement. And that was agreement signed between the shareholders and with the government of Qatar. That was really an achievement, because without all this commitment from the government of Qatar and government of UAE, you won't see this project as alive today. So the other contribution which I feel the benefit to this project and the region itself, it's also in addition to the opportunities open for the citizens of the GCC. The other contribution which we feel proud all of it, and Dolphin Energy, the contribution to the environment. I mean, we have number of recent project initiatives which was about the protecting the coral reef in the Gulf, and the taking care about the turtles in the Gulf. There are a number of environmental initiatives which we really take part. Plus, this was taken from the beginning, because before we started the project, there was a baseline study which was conducted just to make sure that by laying this long pipeline, which is a cross-country between UAE and between Qatar and UAE, we need to have to make sure that there is no impact on the coral reef. And that's something very important. I mean, we cannot just because of business we damage the environment. And I think this is something which we really we issued a book which we call Coral Reef. That book was just recently distributed, and it was launched officially in Qatar and UAE, which highlight all the efforts. A project would take 3 years from the starting, which collecting a lot of data information just before we have this project completed. So project, I think, bring us to a level where we feel that by having this project, by having this pipeline from Qatar and UAE, did not or does not have any impact on the environment and the coral reef. So I don't want to take long time, but maybe there's an opportunity here, since we're talking about the pipeline and the how the importing enhance the relationship between countries. It is because we feel that by having this pipeline between Qatar and UAE and Oman, we feel just like we are connecting three countries. In reality, because now all these gas produced in Qatar, it's been benefited now in UAE and Oman. The demand of natural gas is a huge. With this oil project going on right now in UAE and in Oman, with this gas available in Qatar, I think by having Dolphin Energy extending this pipeline, it is something which we really feel that it's going to enhance the cooperation and the relationship between these three countries. Of course, this experience, which is again offer Dolphin can offer it to any company or any country in the region which can benefit from this success story we had in Dolphin. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Adam. Before I turn the questions over to the audience, I'd like to pose a question of my own. Just as the one on the panel who's not an expert in pipelines, I guess a question that I have that maybe others in the audience might have is, Mr. Adler, you talked about the pipeline connecting three countries and others made similar efforts. How is the nature of a pipeline different in connecting countries than shipping? I mean, you know, there are ships that transport goods and services. Maybe you could each speak a bit about how pipelines are inherently different than shipping and how it impacts the relationship between countries. maybe we can start.
I can just elaborate here more in this area. I think there is a benefit by having the pipeline compared to transporting LNG. Maybe because of the pipeline, talking about from cost point of view, the pipeline, this is my personal opinion again, maybe people can disagree with me, the pipeline is less cost compared to transferring LNG. On the other side, there are some people which they are buying LNG and they have facilities, and when they transfer this LNG to the customer, they have the liquefaction, which they again convert this from liquid to gas, which is again wasting energy. Like in the pipeline, we are just transferring natural gas as it is from the plant, processed natural gas, and goes to the customer directly. So by having this, first of all, it's from cost point of view. The other issue is environment, because in the LNG you're talking about ships, which is transferring the product, and the pipeline you don't talk about ship, it's continuous the supply. It is more reliable compared to LNG, but again, because if LNG, we talked about transferring the LNG to a longer distance, I think LNG here, in my personal opinion, it's much better.
Just to follow up, in the report we have a section which compares LNG transport and pipelines, and this is a quotation I wanted to share with you in this regard from a study done by Rice University and Stanford recently on natural gas worldwide. Very detailed modeling study, used simulation models to look at markets up to 2040, and what they suggest is that infrastructure for natural gas, especially going towards Europe, as Ambassador Rende also suggested, the pipeline infrastructure is already there. So what one thing that makes pipelines better at fostering cooperation is that permanence of infrastructure. And so what they suggest is that it is advantageous for countries in the Middle East to also try and maintain and sustain the pipeline infrastructure from a strategic point of view, and not to put all your eggs in the LNG basket. But as Mr. Adil said, of course, if you're trying to transport gas from Qatar to Japan, you're not going to do it via pipeline. LNG has its place. Keep in mind that Algeria was one of the first countries to start LNG, but they are still very active in pipelines also. As we saw, they've just opened a brand new pipeline just in December from Algeria to Almeria in Spain, another pipeline to Spain. So I think this is an area where I'm glad that Qatar has invested in Dolphin, but they should keep considering other prospects as well in that regard.
LNG is an important energy resource, and every country like Turkey, we are major importers of natural gas. We would like to have a good energy mix, and of course LNG is one of the resources, but we don't have enough storage capacity. When we had problems during the period 2006 and 2007, we could not get enough LNG because we could not store. We had no facilities, and this is why, in the long run, what we are planning to do is, while concluding all the planned pipelines, we would like also to have a reception facility, a new LNG terminal on the Mediterranean, and have a good energy mix. So some gas will arrive by pipelines, and some by LNG, through of course by tankers and in the form of LNG. They suggest that if the pipeline is less than 3,000 miles or 3,000, you might correct me, then it is more feasible. It's feasible. It's cheaper, and to pump it through pipelines. I think this is why, for example, Italy decided to get natural gas through Greece, from Turkey through Greece, and we established the Turkish-Greek-Italy interconnector. But Italy, at the same time, they receive gas from Algeria. They will be receiving LNG from Qatar. the United Kingdom decided to get 20% of its consumption from Qatar in the form of LNG, but they established the necessary infrastructure. As regards pipelines, what is important, and I missed that, is to provide the legal framework, and the pipelines should be used by all countries, transnational pipelines, the non-discrimination principle is very important, and the transparency should be provided, and the fees should be cost-reflective. And therefore, we need more pipelines crossing different areas so that no country will be able to dictate its conditions upon the consumers. This is very important. In the past, we had this problem. And therefore, now the Europeans and the countries in the region are trying to not only diversify the resources, but also the routes, in order to avoid any country from dictating its prices or other conditions upon the consumers.
That's very interesting. Let's turn to the audience. Can I see some hands for people who would like to? Okay, one, two, three. Okay. Said Hassan, do we have extra microphones? Okay.
Hi, I thank you very much. I'm Hassan Al-Jafiri, and my comment is about, due to Al Jazeera, we had a problem with the Saudis and we couldn't extend our pipes to Kuwait, which is in desperate need for our gas. And also, the problem is with the Dolphin, going to all the way to Emirates and then to Pakistan, and then in the long term to India. So again, there is a mess happening. Pakistan authorities allowed the extremists and the fanatics to gain more power and put Pakistan in a mess, so it is not safe now. And in Iran also, Iran one day wants to have the three islands of the Emirates, the other day Bahrain, and then now they're putting the liberals beyond bars. And I expect a lot of mess going to happen in the region. So the pipes, instead of bringing peace to the region, is becoming, more conflicts, especially that also our waters with the Emirates. Again, so the Saudis said that the water is still under conflicts, and this is why we had the project of a bridge to be built between Qatar and Emirates, and it was postponed afterwards. So what is happening now, what I'm trying to say, that it is cost effective to pump gas through pipes and oil too, but it is much easier to protect the seas, like we have the fleets everywhere protecting the seas, but the land is difficult to protect and to assure security and safety. This is why I wrote to my government a month ago and I said perhaps Obama administration could leave any time, so better to persuade the British to have a military base here, to upgrade our military agreement to the level of a British military base, because we are in the middle of the mess. I said if the Americans and the British would take the oil and the gas, they will pay for it, but the Iranians and the Iraqis will take it for free. So it's not easy. So just the last point that I need to make, that there is financial and economic. I don't know why Al Jazeera is not happy with me. He's focusing away from me. Okay. So just the last point I need to make, that there is a financial crisis became economic crisis. So Iran was making the Iranian people quiet by feeding their mouth, giving them subsidized petrol and subsidized food. But now, because of the oil prices coming down, there is going to be a big revolution in Iran that would bring the fanatics down. And the same thing, there is going to be unemployment in Saudi Arabia in the coming few years. And the Saudis want job, and if the unemployment continues, something will happen. So what the pipes would do for us.
Thank you, Mr. Just to leave time for the others.
I just want to quickly respond, but just to say that, maybe you are also getting some misinformation about some of these issues, because clearly with regard to the cooperation, and in the case of Dolphin, some of the border agreements were in fact resolved before the project was started, and it actually motivated the countries to resolve the disputes. So I think we need to be careful in how we present the facts.
But if I can summarize Michel Jaffer's question, is, which is an interesting one for the audience, are pipelines more vulnerable than shipping? Are they less flexible?
No, I mean,
are they more difficult to defend?
We have a security expert here, of course. Mr. Jean is here with us, but he can comment on that if you would like. But the security issue with pipelines, the ones I showed you, Algeria has had a separatist, an insurgency, not a separatist movement, a very strong, violent insurgency for several decades. And those pipelines have been, with proper security operations, have worked fine there. Of course, you need, there are that factors into some of the routing, like I showed you with the Balochistan case, they had to reroute it. But in fact, one of the demands of the Balochi separatists in Pakistan, who are not the fanatics, the Balochi separatists are mostly more secular minded, one of their demands is, we want more revenues from the oil and gas. So if you have a properly configured agreement, this can actually provide you with an opportunity to give those grievances some address as well.
Thank you. We had a question from the ambassador in the front row. تفضل في تكلم بالعربي إذا please عرب
المتدخلين الاثنين على عرضهما المفيدين. وأود بهذا الصدد أن أسجل توضيح.
Please. قرب الميكروفون.
أن أسجل توضيحا. فيما ورد في عرض السيد سليم بخصوص أنابيب نقل الغاز في الجزائر. السيد سليم ذكر بأن العلاقات بين الجزائر والمغرب مقطوعة. هذا ليس صحيح. العلاقات بين الجزائر والمغرب لا تزال على عهدها طبيعية. كل ما هنالك أن قضية الأنبوب الذي كان مخططا أن يمر بالمغرب قد توقف بقرار مغربي، وكانت الجزائر في استراتيجيتها الموضوعة في بداية السبعينات تريد أن تزود جاريها تونس والمغرب بقدر معلوم من ثروتها لكي يمر الأنبوبين عليهما ويستفيدا منهما قبل أن يصلا إلى أوروبا في إيطاليا وإسبانيا. ولذلك فإن قضية الصحراء التي ذكرها ليست سببا رئيسيا لوقف الأنبوب، إنما هي سبب بقرار مغربي خاص به، وقد سبب لنا هذا مشكلا كبيرا في تخطيط هذا الأنبوب، فعوضناها بأنبوب آخر مباشر إلى إسبانيا عبر البحر المتوسط. أريد هذا التوضيح فقط، وأشكر السيدين المتدخلين والجماعة الذين تدخلوا. شكرا.
شكرا سيد السفير. Hiba, maybe if you want to give us a summary better than I can give.
Very quickly, I think the ambassador wanted to clarify something with you, Salim. He said that you mentioned that ties were severed between Morocco and Algeria. They're in fact not severed.
No, what, they were in the past.
بالسابق هل تم قطع العلاقات
من between 19 from about 1974 to 1988 they were severed and then they resumed. Then they were okay. That's what I was saying. I didn't say now they were severed. I said they were severed in the
okay.
past.
So the ambassador is clarifying that the pipeline that was between Morocco and Algeria, the passing of oil in that pipeline has stopped based on a decision on the Moroccan side. And so the issue of the desert is not the problem, but rather a Moroccan decision, as a result of which they have now deviated that pipeline towards Spain, so across the Mediterranean. So the supply of oil and, of oil between Morocco and Algeria has stopped and instead now is deviated towards Spain from Morocco.
Yeah, but that, yes, thank you very much for that comment. Maybe there was some misunderstanding. What I was saying was this new pipeline which the ambassador mentioned just opened in November of last year, so it just started. So yes, now they've done that, but before that what I was trying to show was that through a very difficult period in their relations, the pipelines were operational. For example, in I believe it was in 1994, there was a militant attack at a hotel in Marrakesh in which two Spanish tourists were killed, and Morocco accused Algeria of that incident. Even with that, after all of that difficulty, the oil flowed during that period. And so what I was trying to say is that at that point, they might have severed ties, but they didn't, because there was an economic connection. So, but thank you for the clarification.
We had a question here, and then we'll go to these two. Fadal.
Just slightly playing the devil's advocate. It strikes me that if you're arguing that pipelines cause peace, then once you look at the causes of war, and the risk of oversimplifying the two ones is resource competition and social disintegration. And I was just wondering in which way you saw pipelines actually affecting behavioral change.
Would you like to say
something? I think pipelines can help to enhance understanding and promote security among neighboring countries and among the countries which share the pipelines. We built a pipeline which crosses the Black Sea between the Russian Federation and Turkey. And we receive an important amount of gas through this pipeline. It's a direct pipeline. And it's my impression that the Russian Federation, as this is an important source of income for Gazprom and the Russian Federation, they pumped, for example, oil even when they turned off the gas taps towards Ukraine. In Ukraine, they continued to pump more oil, and they were very careful, for example, to meet very sensitive in meeting the demand of Turkey through this direct pipeline. Let's take the Turkish-Greek-Italy interconnector, the Turkish-Greece interconnector. The relationship between Turkey and Greece have improved, gradually improved. But with such a pipeline connecting the two countries, I believe that there will be more understanding in dealing with more complicated issues, because this is the future of the two countries are also interconnected, because energy is such a crucial resource, and you can't achieve sustainable economic development if you cannot guarantee constant flow, uninterrupted flow of energy and affordable energy. And therefore, when you have such pipelines, even with countries who are not necessarily great friends, I think the administrations, the authorities of these countries, they pay due attention to the interests of the other side and not to, for example, heighten tensions and not to create new problems. This is my humble view, that pipelines can be used and they are not a source of tension or conflict, but I believe that they can improve, enhance stability and security.
Thank you. There's a question here. Then we'll get both of you. Yes.
I want to ask first about transporting gas with pipelines compared with tankers, these equipped tankers. I think this not feasible, maybe feasible, but when we are transporting crude oil by pipelines compared to tankers, super tanker, I think the costs per barrel or per ton is more or less. That's one. The second, which I compare, it's not competitive. There is no competition between pipelines and tankers. Maybe complementary. I saw it in Egypt from Suez to Mediterranean and then completed by tankers. I think in some areas like this. I come to my question now. His Excellency, the Ambassador of Turkey, about the future projects. We know that Obama is planning for independence in 10 years and about offshore exploration, something like this, and the clean energy. Also, the European Union is investing in North Africa, perhaps 100 million in 10 years for clean energy and then exporting electricity there. That is one. What are the influence of these projects on the future pipelines projects? Second, conflicts. Caspian Sea, we have a conflict there. We have a conflict between USA and Iran. I mean, Georgia, Russia. And so, when I was in Afghanistan, we discussed in academic meeting to make a canal from Amudari River through Hindi Kosh with a tunnel and then in Kabul River till Pakistan, till the Arabian Sea, something like this. It was discussed sometimes. So conflicts and future projects, the influence on the future pipelines projects. Thank you.
Would you like to say about LNG? Or?
Yes, again, so you have a point about the fact that it's not a competition. I mean, they are complementing each other, yes, of course. Because as Dr. Salim mentioned here, there are areas you cannot transport gas, natural gas, from Qatar to Japan. There are situations which we need a pipeline and you reach a destination and then you need to complete that by tankers. But point here was talking about the environment only. From environmental point of view, the trucks or the tankers will have more impact on the environment, especially the sea. They might have a pollution, they might have a collision, the accidents, so this could happen. Compared to a pipeline which is more stable, this is generally you don't have that much of problems with the pipeline. That was my point here.
And one additional point with LNG, the environmental cost, in addition to the dangers of transport, also the amount of energy required to produce LNG per unit of output you're getting is very high. In, of course, a country like Qatar, that energy is completely subsidized, so you don't see that in your cost calculations. But you are using enormous amounts of energy to first liquefy the gas, then you have to deliquefy the gas. So the infrastructure needed for one thing is going to be much more, and the environmental cost of the energy being used is very high. So I think that needs to be accounted for when making the decision too. Again, LNG has its place, but I think some of these costs are not considered appropriately.
If I may just say a few things. I agree that LNG has an important. First of all, it part of the energy, the carbohydrate and hydrocarbon, and part of it, it has to be LNG. We send from here, Qatar sends LNG to South Hook station in England. We cannot send it, we cannot pump it by pipelines. It's expensive. You need to liquefy and then regasification, and it costs. But we need in our energy mix a certain amount of LNG in order to improve our demand elasticity, because every country has to think about its demand elasticity. If pipelines are running through your country, and then all of a sudden they don't pump for different reasons, gas doesn't arrive, you need to have storage capacities and you need to have a certain amount of LNG arriving by tankers, and you need renewable energy, hydropower and other power, so that you have a good, healthy energy mix. As regards the security of pipelines, we have managed to protect the Kirkuk, the Iraqi-Turkish pipeline for over 30 years, and it kept running. But for different political reasons, of course, and the war and so on, at a certain period, instead of 1.6 million barrels, we received like about 300,000, 100,000, so it dwindled to nothing. And but each country which signs a host country agreement and gets the fees, transit fees, is under obligation to protect the pipeline. And then they have a very, very complicated security arrangements. For example, the Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan is the first in this series of pipelines. It's so well protected through the satellite systems. They have mobile forces. They have so whenever something happens, they have the capacity to immediately intervene. And so this is through the host country agreements. This is why we get transit fees.
A lot of questions. There was a question here, a woman who had her hand up for a while, and then maybe what we'll do now is take two questions at a time, because I see a lot of hands up. So we'll take these two, and then we'll take those two. Tafadhali.
Is it working?
Yes, hold it close.
Basma Al-Ghaffar, I'm an assistant professor of public policy at the Qatar Faculty of Islamic Studies, Qatar Foundation. This was a very interesting presentation. My question to you is, how did your study distinguish between the impact of the presence of the actual pipelines in interstate relations as opposed to the measures that have to be in place before cooperation is even possible? And also distinguish between the presence of the actual pipelines and the security measures that are then put in place after. So this is basically my question. How did you distinguish between?
So you ask a very interesting question of, in terms of social science research, what we call the question of endogeneity, or the chicken and the egg problem. You know, did the security come first and the pipeline, or the pipeline caused the security? And I think if you look at, you know, this is a dialectical process. You have, there's going to be what we call in track two diplomacy sometimes. There'll be confidence building measures. They lead to some levels of economic cooperation. That reinforces further security cooperation. So it's not a linear process, but what I'm arguing is that the pipelines can play a very important part in that equation. And that, in fact, in the case of some of these pipelines, the first interaction economically between the countries was through the pipeline itself, such as was the case in some of the Transmed projects. So that's how I would present it. But you're absolutely right. You need a certain minimum threshold of interaction before you can get to that point. But the pipelines help to sustain that interaction. So as I mentioned up front, the Haifa pipeline, I don't see it happening until there is some kind of Arab-Israeli conflict resolution. It would be unreal to expect that to happen, even though there was a lot of pressure from the U.S. after 2003 to make it happen. But it was a non-starter. Even the Jordanians, who have diplomatic ties with Israel, they refused. Because, of course, the situation is so dire. So,
in the front, and then on the stairs.
think what we heard in the last 1 hour, it was very informative. But I have an observation here, that we see that from the energy centers, the bias of the flow of energy has been to Europe, Turkey serving as a conduit. Because Europe was an economic hub. With the economics now shifting to the east in Asia, don't you think with another about 10 years or so, all this infrastructure now might become irrelevant?
The ambassador may be able to give more projections on that, but all the models, like this Baker model, which looks into up to 2040, sees enormous rise in demand for Europe also, both Asia and Europe. And keep in mind, there are pipelines being planned to East Asia also, from Kazakhstan to China, then within China also, pipelines which are being planned in various ways. Then Russia is planning, already has a pipeline going towards its far eastern coast to link it to Japan and so on and so forth.
Thank you. It's a very interesting observation. I agree with you that we have new players in the energy politics, India, China, and they're doing everything possible to conclude long-term contracts, short-term contracts in Africa, in the Middle East, in order to meet their energy demand. Now, just because of the global energy crisis, the situation is not so urgent, but I'm sure that in the decades to come, India and China will have to be they will become major energy consumers, and therefore Qatar has in fact invested in time. They were very, in fact, very clever in investing in the LNG industry, and then by sending the first tanker in 1997, it was a huge success for Qatar to be able to send the first tanker to Japan in 1997, and to invest heavily in the LNG when people knew very little about LNG, and LNG was not so fashionable. Everybody was trying to build pipelines and trying to improve, for example, the transit regime of the energy charter. The energy charter was working hard to improve the transit regime, how to improve the legal framework so that that the Russians or others will not be able to impose their wills and conditions on Europe as a whole. Now here, when definitely Qatar and other energy-rich countries will continue to supply to China, India, and Japan by tankers, oil and natural gas, Europe remains one of the major gas consumers, because Europe, in Europe, there is a huge network of natural gas. They use it for heating, they use it for everything. And therefore, the demand is growing. And in Turkey too. This is for example, the Turkish natural gas network in Turkey, and it's growing. So every house, every household is in need of gas, and they cannot do without natural gas. This is the situation, unlike in India or in China. This is the situation in Europe. And therefore, according to the International Energy Agency, Europe's natural gas demand will grow by 70%, which is huge. And of course now the experts of the European Union, they get together, and the energy, DG Energy, and they say, what should we do? How can we meet this? How can we cope with this situation? Because the Russian Federation, with its 48 trillion cubic meters of proven gas reserves, they don't invest, in fact. They don't have the means to invest, or they don't invest enough. So Europe might face a serious problem. Therefore, they just go to Europe, to Algeria, to Nigeria, and other gas producers, and try to diversify their resources.
Okay, we have
many hands and little time. So what I'd like to do is the gentleman on the stairs first has had his hand up for a very long time. And let's just really, there's two gentlemen in the back. Let's really take two questions before we get an answer. So why don't you, and we'll make sure you both get answered your
Thank
questions.
You very much. Just wanted to get a comment from Professor Ali. I work with the local newspaper, Gulf Times, and recently ran a couple of stories on Qatar trying to diversify its water resources. And as part of that story, I came across two interesting pipeline projects. One was Qatar planning to bring fresh water from Turkey, and another one from Iran. But I was told to edit those lines and not even publish that. It was apparently a political issue, and it was very frustrating not to even get any more information on that. Apparently, both projects have been shelved. So I'm left with an impression that within the GCC there might be projects like Dolphin, but outside GCC there's that element of fear, and I just wanted to get your comment on that.
Okay, let's get the second question, please. Sam.
Thank you. My question is to Dr. Salim Ali also. So pipelines have a lifetime as well. And if we take a look at Russia, so Russia has flexed its political muscle recently, and we've seen conflicts being resolved because pipelines are in place. But those are interesting pipelines because they're old, and at some point they will need replacing. And my question to you is, have you looked at what the political consequences of aging pipelines will be in the future? So as those pipelines become older and cease to become relevant, have you seen in Russia or elsewhere, or do you expect to see a disintegration of the political or cooperative fabric that comes with those pipelines?
We do have some engineers also in the audience if they want to talk about the age of pipelines, just quickly, and then I'll come back to Sarmat's question also. Of course, because of corrosion, there's going to be a certain age factor, but with maintenance, pipelines can actually have a longer life than an oil tanker, I can assure you. And there are many factors which go into that, of course, the climate, where they're located, and so on. Just to give you an example, the pipeline from Kirkuk to Haifa was built in 1948, and when after 2003, when the Israelis started to look at the potential of resurrecting it, they suggested that they could actually bring that back into operation with a cost of less than $500 million. So $500,000, $400,000. So $500,000, they felt that they could repair the pipeline within that cost. So shows you that it is, even though they have a lifetime with maintenance, that may not be as big an issue. With regard to Sarmat's question about water and pipelines, that is a much more contentious issue environmentally. If you're going to be transporting water with pipelines, you're going to have lots of losses. There's going to be a lot of other issues. Libya has a huge project to actually transport water from fossilized aquifers in the south of the country up to the north, and they call it the Great Man-Made River, and they have these big expositions about it. But environmentally, it's very problematic, so I think maybe that's one of the reasons why strategically also it's an issue. And the other aspect of water which is strategically important is the pricing mechanisms. And I've done some work on water, if you're interested. I just finished a report for the Asia Society on Water Security. One of the things we looked at is pricing mechanisms for water in the Gulf. There's a lot of resistance to changing pricing regimens for local populations. No one wants to say that there's a water scarcity problem. Like in Dubai, the Dubai Water Authority is $4 billion in debt, but no one wants to admit that in a more public setting because it would suggest that there needs to be some kind of change in conservation policies. And they have decided to now have pricing in Dubai, but only for non-Emirati.
As I work as regards to the waters, the water question, I was the head of the department for water, so the situation is as follows. Turkey proposed 20 years ago a water pipeline, And that was in order to use the unusable waters of two national rivers, not transboundary rivers, that is to be clarified. So we were using not the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers. We were planning to use Jehan and Sehan, which are national waters, and we have 16 billion cubic meters of water feeding into the Mediterranean, not used. So we thought that we can channel through this pipeline, we can pump water as far as the United Arab Emirates and Oman. But for political reasons, it was not found feasible. It was not feasible. Probably today, it might be more feasible because of the new technology. It was more expensive 17, 20 years ago. Today it's less expensive. But again, without improving the political conditions in the region, without having peace between Israel and Palestine, I don't believe that it's going to happen, this pipeline, water. But I believe in water pipelines. We are working also, we have also a commission working on pipeline connecting the Turkish Mediterranean coast with Palestine and Israel to provide in the future water to Jordan, Israel and Palestine. It will be three pipelines running together under the sea, water, gas and oil. But it's still a project, and only the European Bank agreed to finance the feasibility study. As regards maintaining pipelines, you're right, they have maybe 40 years of age. They can last for 40 years or 50 years, but they have to be maintained, and it's much easier to maintain a pipeline or to rebuild a pipeline. If the host country, after 40 or 45 years, does agree to rebuild the pipeline, there's no problem, according to the host country agreement. If the host country decides after 50 years that I am not interested anymore in having this pipeline, then it might be a problem. Thank you.
Let's take a few more questions. There's two questions right here, and is there a third question that I'm missing? Let's do these two first. I saw those two first, and then this one. Why don't we take all three of those questions together?
Hello, I'm Ioana Belu from Global Business Media Agency's representative for Fortune. We've been talking so much about the opportunity for political cooperation that these pipelines, let's say, enhance. I would have two concrete questions for His Excellency, the Ambassador of Turkey. For instance, the Nabucco project, do you think it offers an opportunity for quicker integration into the European Union for Turkey? And also, if it is such an opportunity for political cooperation, why didn't Turkey work with Armenia to settle their issues? We know, for instance, that the so-called Armenian genocide is one of the obstacles to Turkey's accession to the European Union. Thank you.
We're running out of time.
Go ahead. Thank you very much. My name is Odeh Kat from Al Jazeera Channel. I'm engineer from Iraq also, so it's not a problem for me to understand the pipelines. If Mr. Salim can show us the map, please, the same map on the screen. We all see is the missing factor in this equation is Iraq. You know, a peaceful Iraq can help and establish cooperation between the transitions, pipelines in Turkey and the Gulf states, and let's say the two coasts of the Arabian Gulf. So we see that the people here in the Gulf trying to export oil and gas via pipelines toward the south, and Turkey via Caspian Sea and from Armenia, Azerbaijan, from other parties trying to sell oil or transport oil and gas to other countries. The problem is if we establish a pipeline between the southern Gulfian states and Turkey, that will establish also the pipelines of waters that Mr. Mithat is speaking about. It is easier to arrive them via the two rivers of Furat and Euphrates and the Tigris, and by extending the amount of waters and establishing a river to these states, it's easier, I think, than sending water pipes under the sea to the countries that they call Israel, alleged Israel, of course, and Jordan and Syria. I prefer that. It's the better way is using Iraq. But the problem is we
we have a major problem is Iran. Everybody's speaking about this unstable factor in the equation. We have a problem. Everybody tried to avoid in the pipelines Iran. Everybody tried to go away from Iran. So the problem is United States. What's the role of United States? After occupying Iraq 6 years, there is a big mess in Iraq. There's big problems in Iraq. The problem is without peaceful Iraq and without reaching a solution with Iraq, with peace or without peace with Iran, the problem will not be solved. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And the third question.
So Professor Soleimani, as the ambassador had pointed out, that you need a high level of security. Before their pipelines, they've set up satellites versions, high levels of security, and all the aspects. When we look at it, can I say it the other way around, that these are pipelines for war rather than pipelines for peace? Because if you see the anomaly that all these areas will require for all these pipelines and the levels of security, the transportation networks, and then if you see the unintended consequences that the Taliban were originally set up to help the pipeline itself for the Turkmenistan-Pakistan pipeline. So will it not the whole network, when you're looking at it in the future, is actually calling for more conflicts throughout the region?
Thank you. May I start with the first question? First of all, yes, Turkey's contribution to, given its geography, its position, Turkey's contribution as a transit country to the energy security of Europe has been acknowledged in writing by the European Commission and the European Union, and it was put in their white paper. So the aim is to use Turkey as the fourth artery, Russia, Norway, Algeria, and then through Turkey. But of course, not Turkish gas or Turkish oil. Turkey is only a transit country. And for example, Nabucco, 2,000 kilometers of Nabucco will cross Turkey. So we will be the major contributor to the pumping of gas from the Arab gas, Iraqi gas, because also I forgot to mention that the Egyptian gas will arrive in Turkey also through Jordan and Syria, and probably will connect to Nabucco. Of course, we hope that Turkey, you know that Turkey has engaged 39 brigades during the Cold War, thanks to Turkish armed forces, that Europeans managed to live in harmony and to prosper and to industrialize. Today, we have a different role, and we would like to play this role. And of course, probably it will be an important a contribution, and we hope that, of course, the European Union will take into consideration while negotiating with Turkey, it will take into consideration also our contributions. As regards the so-called the Armenian-Turkish issue, you know that we sent our president to Armenia. There is a process of normalization of relations. Our president went to Armenia to watch a football match, and then the process started, and we have achieved a great deal. And when the time comes, probably the necessary statements will be made. But we have a good process going on. As regards the question whether pipelines are a source of conflict or a source of stability, this is of course very interesting. As you said, you rightly said that if you build a pipeline through the Taliban area, Taliban will continue, probably, if we cannot achieve peace there, Taliban will try to make use of it in order to harm the interests of the West or the Americans. But every pipeline is serving more people. It's serving the economies and the well-being of the people. So we have to think that pipelines, first of all, are a source of stability. We have to protect them. We have 10 or 15 pipelines in 10 years will be going through Turkey to the West. It's our duty to protect them. And I would like to believe and I would like to convince you that pipelines are a source of stability and security, not conflict.
Thank you. Just quickly to respond to about the situation in Iraq, of course, we are all very concerned about it. I did interview the State Department's energy liaison officer for pipelines in Iraq, and he actually mentioned that the State Department would not be averse to even an Iraq-Iran pipeline. There have been in the past pipelines between Iraq and Iran, and that they would consider waiving the Iran Sanctions Act, actually, if that were to move forward as a gesture of goodwill. And of course, as you know, the Turkey pipeline is operational, and I think there should be efforts made to try and improve the situation there, so I totally agree with you on that account. The security question, I think the ambassador has admirably addressed it. The main, if you're interested in the Taliban case, actually Ahmad Rashid, the famed journalist, his book on the Taliban, he goes to great lengths to describe actually how oil and gas was actually a cooperative mechanism even in those sort of dark days of the Taliban. You know, you had the Taliban delegation visiting Houston, another delegation went to Buenos Aires in Argentina. Unbelievable. Would that have happened if it wasn't for oil and gas cooperation at that point? Now, the next question to ask is, can oil and gas then be used as a means of manipulating interests so that you can give a pass to people like the Taliban, whom you may not otherwise want to negotiate with? That's a reasonable question to ask. But in fact, if you're just talking about basic cooperation, even with the Taliban, there is ample proof to show that when in 1998, when the negotiations were underway for the TAPI project, you had the Taliban engaging with the U.S. and not actually calling the U.S., you know, all the bad names that they now call the U.S.
I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there. Mr. Adil, Dr. Salim, Ambassador Mithat, thank you very much. I want to thank the audience and for being with us, the staff of the Brookings Doha Center, and encourage you to stay with us for refreshments for a bit. Thank you very much.